Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Italian film producer and director Federico Fellini. And I think probably to start off with, Mike, we should do a crash course in a little bit about what Italian neorealism was all about.
Well, think about the fact that the Italian film industry kept going during World War II, but very much under the Mussolini regime. You know, it was a fascist regime, which happened to love films and filmmaking. So on one hand, it was viable. You know, directors kept working. On the other hand, there were all sorts of strictures. As World War II was drawing to a close, and then, of course, would end in 1945, the Italian studios were there. They were up and running. Many of the first films that were made, ironically, though, were made outside of the studios because the studios had been requisitioned for hospitals and military efforts and blah, blah, blah. And so one reason why they worked in the streets for the early neorealist films was that sometimes, ironically, those studio facilities weren't quite available at the time. Secondly, though, was that impulse to capture reality as it was unfolding. And so the real landmark film would be Roberto Rossellini's Rome, Open City in 1945. Now, to your point, the hallmarks of Italian neorealism, the fact that a lot of it would be done in the streets, though I've got to say, all neorealist films, almost all of them also had some studio work or, you know, constructed sets, but the impulse to work in the streets, to capture reality. Secondly, to use non-professional actors. And again, I've got to qualify that immediately because most neorealist films have actually a mixture of at least some professional actors and non-professionals. But certainly when you have a street scene, a lot of people on the street are of the street and they're playing roles close to what they are in life, if you will. Third, on a technical note, having really kind of basic functional camera work and editing, not fussy, not fancy, just straight on presentation for the most part. And in Rome, Open City, for instance, there's a grainy quality to the film stock itself, which gives it or lends support to a kind of quasi-documentary feel. And there's a pragmatic reason for that. It was hard to get film in those really desperate years in the mid-40s, and Rossellini just grabbed whatever film he could find, you know? And you end up with like sort of like sloppy seconds, right? You don't get the best quality film stock. And ironically, that's turned to advantage, isn't it? As you watch scenes in Rome, Open City, you feel like they're really happening. And that film takes place at the very end of the Nazi occupation of Rome. So it's so close to the headlines in that respect. Well, what's the Fellini connection? Fellini had been working as a scriptwriter in Rome at that point. And also he and some friends ran a store called the Funny Face Shop. And what it was, Fellini's background includes being a journalist, a cartoonist, any number of things, but most importantly for our purposes, writing for the radio and writing for film. So he had a lot of experience already by the early to mid 40s in being in the film industry, but he hadn't really broken through as an individual talent per se. He was just working on scripts and doing things in that regard. He had met Rossellini at least briefly, but the real breakthrough, and it's a wonderful story, I think, is that the Funny Face Shop was set up with American GIs in mind. The American soldiers occupying Rome at that point would stop into the store. They could buy postcards, they could have photographs taken to send to their loved ones back in the States. They could actually do recordings. They could record their voices like verbal greetings. You know, this is high tech at the time, right? You could record yourself and send that back to your family in the States. And the other thing that was relevant to Fellini was, as he was running the shop, in addition to being a cartoonist and a journalist and all these things that have him really tapped into daily life, he loved drawing caricatures. You can already see in embryonic form everything he'd do in his later film career, right? It's all there. And so GIs could stop in and have caricatures made of themselves. Well, Rossellini stopped in one day, and he was a customer, but he was looking for Fellini because he wanted to get Fellini to help him recruit an actor for Rome, Open City. That's what got Fellini pulled into that film. Fellini, therefore, was on the writing team for Rome, Open City. And moreover, in the late 1940s, he worked on several other Rossellini films. So he directly comes out of that Italian neorealism that was so influential in the late 1940s. Rome, Open City was a real eye-opener. It's about as anti-Hollywood as you can get, though it does have theatrical elements to it in its casting and some of the scripting. But by the late 40s, think about films like Vittorio De Sica's Bicycle Thieves and so on. These are the landmarks of Italian neorealism, and they are widely shown in the United States, throughout Europe. When people think about Italian film in the immediate post-war period, it's Italian neorealism. Now, Fellini directly comes out of that, But as we'll talk about, as he starts to make his own films, he's in it and he's not in it. And we can talk about that with some of the early work. And you really see Fellini pulling away, breaking away, establishing his own identity, which is anything but that of a neorealist.
You know, another thing I might add about neorealism is, you touched on it when you said, you know, sort of anti-Hollywood. And I think that's a big part of it, because it wasn't just that post-war they didn't have the money that Hollywood had for big studios and the big contracts that they would give, you know, name brand people to be involved in the movies. But it was also a reaction to, well, that's how Hollywood does it. You know, we're going to do our own thing. And we want it to be realistic in a way that hasn't been done before. So stripping away all the artifice, you know, taking the handheld cameras out into the streets, using regular people, this was considered very daring and avant-garde for its time. I mean, now we're kind of used to cinema verite and that kind of thing, but it was really very daring to take that approach.
Everything you're saying is accurate, but it's a bit more nuanced and complex in the sense that even in its heyday, Italian neorealism wasn't always true to every one of its declared ideals. And we see that with film movements, don't we? Like A Manifesto goes out, and then you see, we talked about this, you know, the other week on another episode in terms of Dogma 95 and the Scandinavian directors. And Italian neorealism, if you read what amounts to The Manifesto by Cesare Zavattini, a screenwriter, point by point, it's everything you mentioned. That's what they're aspiring to do. When you actually watch the film, watch them now, you have a response of, well, it's true, it's there, but you know what? There's also an element of theatricality oftentimes. In the casting, people like Anna Magnani were stage actors. She has the big gestures. She gives a star performance. Very realistic, yes, but you know, it's a star on screen. Technically, some ways in which it pulls away from what the declared manifestos would have it be. And as you watch the films, you realize that, you know, even in the staging, there are outdoor scenes that essentially are documentary footage, you know? But you also have scenes in Rome Open City, for instance, office scenes and apartment scenes that are very much constructed sets. So, you know, I mean, push come to shove, it is everything neorealism declares itself to be. But when you actually watch it, and particularly from some distance now, all these years later, you tend to focus, I think, or find elements that are a bit more theatrical, more conventional. And that's not necessarily a value judgment. That's not necessarily a bad thing, right? But simply by way of genre description, that it was not always as pure as the manifestos might declare.
Let's talk about some of Fellini's early work. Where do you want to start?
Well, let's start with his very first feature film. As a director, he's actually a co-director. He and Alberto Lattuada co-directed a film called Variety Lights. And not at all unusual in the Italian film industry to be an apprentice to an established director, to even co-direct something, to work on the script as well. He kind of edged his way or worked his way in. And it's important to bear in mind that Fellini had absolutely no training technically at all. He had come from the Adriatic coastal city of Rimini, very much a middle-class provincial background. He went to Florence, started working, you know, in cartooning and journalism, all things I talked about, moved to Rome. The reason he went to Rome initially, though, was not film-related. His parents were very conventional middle class, very bourgeois. You can see some of the satirical subject matter already for his films, very Catholic as well. How could he not be very Catholic at that point in Italy? When he went to Rome, it's because he had promised his parents that he would enroll in law school. And being a dutiful Roman Catholic son, you know, he did that, right? But he never attended classes. And when he was asked about that years later, he said, well, I promised my parents I would go to law school. I never promised I would attend class. And so when he started setting up the Funny Face shop and working on screenplays and writing for the radio, he's getting into the industry that way. So when he co-directs that first film, Lattuada, Lattuada handled the filmmaking from a technical aspect, you know, where to put the camera, how to edit, all those things. I mean, not that Fellini didn't play a role there, but, you know, Lattuada handled the technical end because he was an established director. Fellini worked more with the actors, and Fellini's career really is so character-driven, isn't it? Working with, whether professional or non-professional actors, you know, working with them to get the look he wants, the emotions he wants, and so he sort of handled it that way. Now, their first film, Variety Lights, 1950, is already inherently theatrical. It's about what we would call music hall performers. So already Fellini is, you know, dealing with theatrical subject matter. So the approach to it's realistic, fairly conventional, actually, but the subject matter itself is already inherently theatrical, isn't it? The second film, which comes out just a year or two later, White Chic, is very much about the world of imagination, fantasy, cartoon figures, comic strip figures, if you will. So already in those first couple films, you see that his subject matter is establishing itself as being, you know, out of the imagination, out of the world of theater, of make-believe.
You know, it's interesting you mention comic strips a couple of times, because Fellini says that he learned the essence of comedy from comic strips and was a big fan of Flash Gordon as well. He says he discovered comic strips and the circus at the same time, and the characters of comic strips are clowns.
Now, Fellini loved to talk about himself, and there's a strong autobiographical impulse throughout his career and in so many of the films. You've got to be careful with that, though, because he's a wonderful storyteller, but at what point are the stories true or not true? The most famous, or one of the most famous such stories, involves the circus. He loved to tell the story that when he was a small boy, he ran away to join the circus. We all know that as a figure of speech, but that he actually ran away to join the circus and then eventually returned home to his parents. Some of his relatives and friends have said, well, not quite. He didn't actually run away. So what do you believe? Well, I'll opt for the better story, right? The better story is that he ran away to join the circus. But you're absolutely right. His interest in cartooning, his interest in the circus, these go back to childhood. And then in his early professional career, he's able to make his living with things like that. So when you see a film like Variety Lights from 1950 or The White Sheik from 1952, you're looking at overtly theatrical subject matter that taps into cartoonish, almost grotesque caricatures sometimes, comic caricatures, and also stories that are really satirical and very closely related to comic strip fashion, frame by frame, story by story. And what we should mention at this point is, from the get-go, from the earliest films, his films are episodic. They're picaresque, to use a literary term. They wander, they meander. His third film, for instance, E.V. Deloney in 1953, is on the one hand very realistic in terms of looking at a group of young adult men who just are hanging out. The equivalent today would be hanging out in front of the convenience store or something. They're just knocking around the coastal town, not doing much of anything. And the film only has a very loosely constructed plot. It's very much a character study, and it takes its time. Now think about that in terms of almost every subsequent film. He's already setting the model, if you will, for his career in terms of subject matter, in terms of style. Stories that aren't looking to be conventional, beginning, middle, end. They wander, they meander, they take their time, and that's fine. They're giving you a sense of character, a sense of ambiance, a sense of fantasy and imagination, even within a realistic context. So that's in his first three films. And now let's go on to what really is his international breakthrough, La Strada.
Well, you know, he says that all of his movies are about himself. He says, even if I set out to make a film about a fillet of sole, it would be about me. So let's talk about how he sort of blends in his own worldview and makes everything autobiographical, no matter what his subject matter is, starting with the movie you just mentioned.
La Strada really is a breakthrough. It wins the Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. It's a big critical and commercial success. He is a celebrity at that point. And in terms of the structure of it, in terms of the subject matter of it, it's very much one of those episodic wandering films. On the one hand, it is neorealism. It involves Anthony Quinn as a one-man circus performer, if you will, and Julieta Messina, who was Fellini's real-life wife, as Gelsomina. And she's a really quirky character who travels with him. They go through all the provincial towns, and the film is shot on location. It's breathtaking in terms of a neorealistic look at what Italy was in that period. But simultaneously, it's very theatrical, right? It's this circus strongman figure, the one played by Anthony Quinn, Zampano, and Gelsomina. And so it's very much character-driven, their relationship. That he's really brutal. He's really sadistic. She's really meek. She's perhaps mentally challenged. She's also is perhaps magically gifted. I mean, there's an enigmatic quality to her as a character, but their relationship as they travel through Italy, that episodic quality. And Fellini had a quote once where he said, all of my films are a journey. This doubles back on what you were asking. All the films to some degree are autobiographical, and that is a journey, isn't it? As he looks at life, his own life, and he has characters then that are variations on what he is as a person, and as importantly, what he was. He has a very strong nostalgic pull to his own background, his own origins in Rimini. The fact that Rimini's on the Adriatic coast, it's on the sea. There's so much water imagery in Fellini's films, including La Strada. Crucial scenes take place on a beach, don't they? Women are associated with water. It all goes all the way back to I guess Botticelli's, Venus, Venus on the half shell, as they say, of women coming from the water, being associated with it. Those are metaphoric impulses that may not always hold up to logical analysis, but Fellini doesn't really care about logical analysis. He goes with dreams and fantasies, his own recollections, the storytelling that I mentioned before. Was it a true story or not? What's it matter if it's a good story? You believe the story, don't you? And the story has a kind of truth. And therefore, the neorealism and the theatricality are fused together. And let's put it another way. What's real and what's fantasy, increasingly in his work, become blended in such a way that they're treated equally. And you're not even sure sometimes if something's real or fantasized. And ultimately, maybe it doesn't even matter. What I'm saying is that there's a kind of truth to the fantasy as well. Every bit is real as the quote-unquote neorealistic elements.
Now, La Strada and another of his very famous movies, La Dolce Vita, is actually a little bit hard to find. You can't find it on Amazon Prime and you can't stream it from Netflix. You have to either resort to having Netflix send you the discs or purchasing it directly from Amazon or someplace like that. But you can find Knights of Cabiria, which is, one of his movies about loneliness, also starring his wife. And she has sort of, to bring in the idea of the clown, she looks a little like Chaplin's little tramp with a touch of Lucille Ball. What do you think, Mike?
That's a really good description of her. She's got this rounded face and she's made up like a clown sometimes in terms of a kind of pancake makeup and dark circles around the eyes, if you will, to play up the eyebrows, the eyelashes, to make the big eyes even bigger, a really charming smile. Again, this is from a director who's also her husband, but when he looks at her, he thinks about essentially, when I say clown face, I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. I mean simply that he's looking on the expressive qualities of a face, right? Just in the way that a clown would physically express. Because Gelsomina in La Strada has very little dialogue. She communicates oftentimes through physical movement, through the facial gestures. And again, the makeup there should be clown-like because she and Zampano, the Anthony Quinn character, are traveling performers. They're circus artists, right? So you should look like a clown because you're going to the town square and you're setting up your show. He's the strong man and she plays instruments and she does comic numbers. And it's essentially a variation on music hall entertainment. So it's very much in the Chaplin-esque tradition there. And again, that's part of the theatrical impulse that you find throughout his films. In Knights of Cabiria, she plays, on the one hand, a very different character, because Cabiria is a prostitute, just to cut to the chase on that. But it goes beyond the stereotype of the hooker with the heart of gold, because she's a really good, genuinely good person. And a lot of life's misfortunes are inflicted on her. People abuse her, they take advantage of her, they're really nasty to her. And she suffers in the film, but she's got this life spirit, this life-affirming spirit. So as the film goes along, it's ultimately not depressing. Again, it's very episodic, all the terrible things that happened to Cabiria. And you got to wonder, of course, about any writer slash director who casts his wife as a prostitute. And that's probably worth a half hour discussion right there. But then, you see the way in which her character, so it's a character study, she will endure all those picaresque adventures and somehow find still some goodness that life is worth living. It's actually uplifting ultimately, even though to describe it, scene by scene, you might think it's terribly depressing. It's not. Her spirit lifts it. So, of course, does Nina Rota's music, which means a lot to Fellini's films. And he's always looking for ways to have the music elevate the material. And the filmmaking itself, he's breaking away from neorealism, isn't he? He's getting more expressive with his camera work and his editing and all those elements. He's really, by that point in the mid-50s, really pulled away from it.
You can still see some of the influences of the neorealist bent with the focusing on misfits and outsiders on the fringes of society and meditations on hope and survival in Italy. But also, this is kind of where you start to see how Fellini likes to focus on show business or low business in terms of, exploring the underworld or maybe the hidden corners of society where interesting characters lurk, especially if he can weave them into some sort of dreamlike significance.
Well, again, bear in mind that background. He was a journalist. He covered court cases. He saw the gamut of humanity come into a courtroom. He was a cartoonist. He made caricatures. He's fascinated by physical types. When he does his casting, and this has been true throughout his career, sometimes somebody's cast because they're a name actor and he wants that person. But most often what he's doing is he's looking for the right physical look. He casts based on physical appearance. And so whether somebody's professional or non-professional, how does this person look? And we'll worry about other things later. Do they look right for the part? And
yeah,
so when
we'll worry about the dialogue later too, because he wouldn't even film the dialogue.
Well, no, but a lot of Italian filmmakers at that point in the 40s and 50s would essentially shoot silent. And then Cinecittà, the main studio in Rome, there was actually a whole unit set up for dubbing. And ironically, those films were dubbed not just in other languages for other markets, they were dubbed into Italian so that the domestic audience could watch them. But it's a fascinating subject as to why in Italy that developed. One reason, actually, and this is very telling in terms of Italian political culture, is that Italy is a very unionized country. And there was a dubbers union. You know, the people who did all that post-sync stuff, they had their own union and they wanted a certain amount of work. So within the studio structure, they had to get their work too. But for Fellini, what it meant throughout his career was he could stand on the sidelines behind the camera with his megaphone and shout instructions to the actors. And, you know, and it didn't matter because they were, you know, that sound may have been recorded, but it wasn't what would ultimately be released, right? They were going to dub it back in the studio. Moreover, as he started working with more international actors, whether in, you know, Lestrade, Anthony Quinn's, you know, American actor, whether he's working in Richard Basehart, who's also in that film, you know, American Hollywood actors, basically. And then by the time you get to like Dolce Vita and Eight and a Half, you have actors from all over. You have American actors, French, German, you name it. And sometimes when they were shooting a scene, the actors could speak in their own tongue. And then back in the studio, they would just dub it into Italian. And the fact that oftentimes it seems sloppy, that the words you're hearing don't quite match the way the lips are moving, Fellini could care less about that. It didn't matter to him. He's not finicky that way at all. So certainly by the time you get to Cabiria, you're getting a much more expressive style of filmmaking. Let me very quickly give a quote from Fellini himself, because Nights at Cabiria actually comes out in 1957, okay? That very same year, in an interview, Fellini says this, because remember, neorealism was considered something so sacrosanct. By that I mean, it was so closely associated with the very identity of Italian film in the post-war years that when directors dared to pull away from it, for whatever reason, they were oftentimes criticized. Like, well, you know, what's he trying to do? It's not realistic. It's not this or that. Fellini was really bothered by that. And here's what he said in a 1957 interview in terms of how he, by that point, was pulling away from neorealism. This is Fellini, again, speaking in 1957. Remember, after the war, our themes were ready-made. Primitive problems, how to survive, war, peace. These problems were topical, immediate, brutal. But today, the problems are different. Surely the neorealists would not hope for the continuation of war and poverty just because it gave them good material.
That is a great quote, which brings me to, we need to sort of do a speed dial of what we want to say about his movies that came after the ones we just discussed. But, you know, in particular, can you address the idea of these movies being Fellini-esque and what that would mean?
Well, again, that's a reputation that begins by the time he's making Lestrade in 1954. He's establishing his own directorial identity. He has such a strong personality that whether he's in the film himself, and in his later films, he actually will appear on camera or you'll get narration or something. But in any event, with his casting, using actors like Marcello Mastroianni and Giulietta Messina, he's, you know, making his presence known through those things. So, you know, in La Dolce Vita, you have Marcello Mastroianni, you know, his most famous film, you have Marcello Mastroianni playing a journalist in Rome, and it is the Dolce Vita. This is post-war Italy. The economic hardship is increasingly in the rearview mirror. Italy is starting to prosper and thrive. Certainly parts of Rome are laden with celebrities, laden with people with a lot of money, the nouveau riche, if you will. And the film is a very long and leisurely, satirical and sentimental look at them. I should point out that by the time he's making films like La Dolce Vita in 1960 and his masterpiece, Eight and a Half, in 1963, you've got really large casts, really long running times because they're so episodic and so on. But the point I want to make here is that increasingly he's working less in the streets, not only more in the studio, specifically Cinecittà, his main studio, the main studio in Rome, but by the time he gets to Eight and a Half, virtually the whole film is made in the studio. It would be easy to go out to the street. It'd be easy to go out to the ocean or somewhere else. But most often he would rather make that up and totally control it, master the universe within the studio. So part of what Fellini-esque means is he's creating a world, and if it looks artificial, it's meant to. He's not trying to fool you into thinking this is an actual street or this is an actual outdoor location. It's very stylized. It's very much coming from his imagination as much as from what's out there in the real world. So Fellini-esque, among other things, means that. Also in terms of subject matter, everything we've been saying about the circus, about performative qualities of life where people act out, where people are overtly theatrical, and where the films themselves have a really, 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 really kind of scattershot quality deliberately. He just loves the gamut of humanity.
Now, I did want to mention a movie that I discovered. It's a 2017 movie called In Search of Fellini. And it is actually, it comes to pass because Nancy Cartwright, otherwise known as the voice of Bart Simpson, made a movie about her real life goal to try to meet Fellini. She discovers this movie, immediately falls in love with them, and just, you know, gets it into her head she must go to Italy and meet Fellini. So it's about her journey, and you get to see great scenes of Rome and of Verona and of Venice. And she meets all of these Italians and has all of these great, you know, philosophical discussions about Fellini and his works. And when she's describing the movies, Fellini's movies, to her mother and her aunt, she says they're amazing. They're not like American movies at all. The endings are really sad. Sometimes nothing makes sense, and they're kind of dirty. So she's, you know, traveling, and then they cut back to her mother and her aunt watching these Fellini movies. So you see, on the one hand, she's having all these great conversations with Italians about Fellini, and then they cut back to her mother and her aunt going, this is weird, right? There's no plot, right? So I just wanted to throw that out there because it's a really good movie to watch if you've ever tried to watch Fellini and thought, this just seems so highbrow. I can't seem to get my arms around it. I can't figure out, you know, if it's me, if I'm just, you know, I just have no taste or I can't appreciate art. What would you say, Mike, to people who are afraid of Fellini and the sort of dark topics that he deals with and the lack of what we would call an American sensibility to the way he approaches movie making?
You have to watch the film as if you were immersed in a dream.
Yes.
You have to go with the flow. If you insist on beginning, middle, end, and strict plotting and a streamlined story, it's going to be frustrating. But quickly, in terms of his later career, some films that you really should watch, Juliet of the Spirits from 1965, in many ways, just as 8.5, looks very much at a film director, Marcello Mastroianni's character, who really is a reflection of Fellini at that point in his career. That's the male psyche. For the female psyche, Juliet of the Spirits has a real-life wife, Juliana Messina, as a housewife whose philandering husband, ironically, kind of resembles the Mastroianni character in 8.5. But of the later films, some of the more viewer-friendly ones, if you will, certainly The Clowns, Fellini's Roma, Amarcord, for sure. And what I would recommend is if you do watch at least a few of those films and you really want to get a sense from the inside of what he was like as a personality, the Fellini within the Fellini-esque, there's a film of his that's much more deserving of attention than it's gotten, namely a film called Intervista from 1987. It's his most overtly autobiographical film. It's all about Cinecittà. And Cinecittà is a city unto itself. It's a cinema city where Fellini lived, essentially. And it's a film about making a film there. And Fellini's on camera a lot, actually, directing scenes, talking. You get some scenes that are meant to be the film within the film, but then it pulls back and you see the camera and there's Fellini directing the action. It's really a wonderful film in a lot of ways. And most movingly, it's really incredibly moving. He has a reunion between Marcello Mastroianni and Anita Ekberg. They'd have that famous scene in the Trevi Fountain in La Dolce Vita. And here they are reunited. They're sitting in her living room outside of the city. Many years later, watching La Dolce Vita together, you see them in the present day of 1987, but then you see them watching themselves back in 1959, 1960, the period for Dolce Vita. And to see them now and then to have them watching themselves then, it's just incredibly moving to have that. And so, you know, if you've watched some of these other Fellini films, watch the film that you just mentioned or watch Intervista, and you get a real sense of Fellini in terms of the career and the personality.
You know, they asked Fellini, you know, what would you be if you weren't a director? And he said, an actor, singer, a painter, a circus performer, a musician, a writer, and a doctor in a mental institution. I am very fortunate as a director, I can be all of these.
And as a director, that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to keep making movies. In Intervista, he says, for him, the greatest moment is to shoot the first scene of a new film. You know what I mean? I mean, the world's ahead of you, right? It's coming out of your imagination. And you get on the set and you have a script, but he would often ignore scripts and just start improvising. What hits him in the moment? It's that intuitive thing. He's tapping into his subconscious, and a script can only account for a certain amount of that. Otherwise, you go with the flow that way. So watching his films, even though the subject matter sometimes might be on the dark side, the treatment is almost always much lighter.
And that is a great place to leave it. Don't forget to check us out on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com for other episodes. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.